Good afternoon.
Well, afternoon.
Yeah.
A rainy afternoon here.
Yeah. Rainy, dark, humid, kind of gross.
Entirely appropriate.
Yeah, I love the Pacific Northwest. I really do, and I'm going to spend some small amount of time trying to convince you to move here because I've decided I don't want cheap housing in this part of the world.
I'm the exact opposite. I just talk up the weather. It rains here all the time. Do not come.
Yeah, but that's the other side of it. Is right now this is, you know, I'm not gonna lie. I'll take this over Chicago winters any day of the
agreed.
Week.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Yeah. Well, we're all just Nanook of the North and like pushing through the wind.
Yeah, and the insides of my nose is just eroding away as the lack of humidity just causes my insides to freeze up like, and crack out like I'm some sort of cocaine user. Instead, it's just wet and foreboding and dark. And because it's like, it's what, 2:30? It's 3 right now, and it's dinner time
right,
out there.
The sun is on its way down.
Yeah.
It's a good thing there's a moon that'll be the brightest thing in the sky.
Yeah, I mean, we all, all three of us chose to live here. What do you feel about the winters, Josh?
Well, I feel that climate change is going to actually kind of balance it out for us in the future, especially in the next 4 years.
It'll be so much more brighter. It'll be so much more bright here when the sun explodes.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Welcome to Ask an Atheist. 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. My name is Sam. Joining me is Ron John.
Hello, hello. Good to see you again.
Hello. And Josh, how are you?
Doing great.
Yeah.
as well as we can be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. I came to you all heart aflutter and happiness in my voice nary a week ago regarding the supreme victory of the Chicago Cubs. And this is a... honestly, not that much different of a week, but we'll talk about that later. But I really want to talk about something that means something very important to me. Like I said, we're talking about Tacoma. We're talking about this imposing, wet, dark weather that we're experiencing right now. We're talking about the Pacific Northwest. The Satanic Temple of Seattle has been approved to begin an after-school program at Tacoma's Point Defiance Elementary. December 14th will mark the first open house meeting where Point Defiance parents, students, teachers, and staff are welcome to attend. After that, club will meet on the second Wednesday of each month. The Satanic Temple only seeks to operate clubs in schools that already host evangelical good news clubs. Satan clubs focus on critical thinking, science, and rationalism by way of games and projects. Several parents appealed to the Tacoma School Board on Thursday to bar the group from meeting at their children's school, but board members and Superintendent Carla Santorno responded that to do so, the district would have to deny all other groups use of the school building.
That's exactly what the Satan, what the Satanist clubs are there for. Like,
yeah.
What the Satan club is literally there to present. It's like, okay, you like the idea of religious clubs, but you only like it when they're the religions that you like.
Yeah.
So we're going to present you with an alternative that changes one little thing. So they're basically, you know, their whole purpose has been to present this sort of science fiction in real life. We're going to give you the real world, but we're going to change this one little thing and women run everything or whatever it is, right?
Right.
So in this case, it's like, we're going to change this one little thing. Beelzebub is Satan.
Right.
Or is Beelzebub is now your Jesus.
Right.
And let's see how the world reacts. We've secretly replaced Jesus with Satan. That's it. That's their pitch. So this for them is a complete success because they got the superintendent to say it's this or nothing.
Yeah.
Pick.
Now, I'm actually surprised that they didn't pick nothing.
They can't at this point. Honestly, I think they're going to try and fight as much as possible because they think they have the majority. So,
right. Well, they do.
Christians believe that they can ride on the majority is what I mean.
It's right.
Like, they think they have, since they have the majority, they can actually influence politics even at the elementary school level by sheer will.
Yeah. I mean, this is basically it. There's more of us, and what you're doing is reprehensible to us, therefore you need to stop. Oh, yeah, by the way, the Good News Clubs needs more money for cupcakes, basically, is what this is, a lot of it. I'll be honest with you. I was kind of caught with... I was caught off guard by this one. I was going to say I was caught with my pants down, but that's not really a comparison I want to make when talking about an elementary school.
Or the Good News Clubs.
Or the Good News Clubs. Yeah. I didn't know this meeting was going on. I mean, I knew Tacoma was going to be the host of the first after-school Satan Club.
You were about to say hotbed, weren't you?
I was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm proud of that. Like I said, I'm proud of the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Consider the Pacific Northwest, where nothing is cheap. But I felt a little bit of pride. I don't know how personally I, you know, how if I personally influenced the decision to be in Tacoma or not. I don't think I did. I'm just really glad that it happened here in Tacoma, and
right.
I think this is a very good thing, and it's good for the South Sound, and I think it's good for America.
Right.
And I mean, it's an after-school club. I don't want to give the kids too much attention because it's going to totally make everything look artificial, and I already worry that because this is, let's be honest, this is a bit of a ploy. This is an influence decision. This is an influence
right.
plan. It's
mm-hmm.
it's not so much to make after, they don't want after-school Satan clubs in every school in the United States.
Right.
What they want is not good news clubs
right.
in every school in the United States. That's why
I present it as this sort of science fiction pitch.
Right.
Right? That they're going locally to where there is an example of a good news club, and they're saying, well, what if we were to take, if we were to do something like the good news club, but not Jesus, something else,
right.
how would you feel about that? Well, when you present it as a hypothetical, they're like, oh, well, we welcome all religions. You know, you can come here and you can be whatever you want to be, whatever. You know, I will jokingly sometimes tell people that my parents didn't have a lot of influence on my career. They always were opening to me being any kind of doctor I wanted to be. and this is the religious version of that. That
yeah.
like, you know, we're open to all religions and all faiths. It doesn't matter what church you go to, you have a home here.
Yeah.
And there have actually been people who've literally said exactly that, not realizing that they're saying what I'm saying when I'm saying it as like a sarcastic joke and that's their actual thing.
Especially when you're using, they'll use the lingo of church, which is a right. specific religious
right.
institution, as opposed to like, if they would have kept it open, it's like any religious institution. But no, it's not a mosque, it's not synagogue, it's not temple, it's church.
Yeah.
Right.
Far be it to quote the movie of Our People, Ron John, but this is both kinds of music,
mm-hmm.
country and Western.
Yes.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing. I'm glad it's happening here. I do want to, you know, I'm a little bit of two minds from here. Maybe you guys can help me out here in the studio and everybody can kind of give me some pointers on this one. Especially, hey, if you're listening to this show and you're here in Tacoma, I want your feedback. Now, there's two sides of my brain that are coming in here. There's the Sam, the host of Ask an Atheist, the guy who pretends to be a journalist, who wants to cover this thing wall to wall. Who says, this is the first one in the nation. This is a big opportunity for the show. This is a good opportunity for, potentially a good opportunity for the kids and the parents who were involved in this. We could really make this into something. We can bring some attention and actually raise the awareness of these good news clubs, which every atheist I've ever talked to knows exactly what I'm talking about when we talk about these good news clubs. But you get off the atheist island and you talk to people who aren't focused on this sort of thing, and they have no idea what you're talking about. They don't know about these groups. And that's part of what this after-school Satan thing is designed to do. So part of me is saying, yeah, we need to cover this because this is part of what's going on. Now, there's the Humanists of Washington guy, the sort of social activist, the community organizer part of me that says, you know, I don't know that these kids need a lot of undue attention.
Mm-hmm.
So either I stay the well away and
right.
let these kids and parents and teachers do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or assist them in the after-school Satan Club. Like, hey, would you guys like to learn how to produce a podcast where you talk about rationality? I can help you do that. Like, I'll bring the gear in and you can do this. You run the whole show. And you just ask me questions on how things work. You know, I could help with activities on that sort of thing. We work with Camp Quest Northwest, where science, skepticism, and rationalism is what we do for
right.
a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of material there that Becky has that could be of assistance to them. Should Camp Quest Northwest be involved in this? You know, so I've got a host of possibilities here that range from nothing, which is usually what I do, to go absolutely bug crap insane about it and just do and just go full bore. I mean, where would you go with this, Josh? If you were in this position, or if you are in this position, where do you think we should go?
Middle ground. I mean, honestly, because the thing is, activism always causes a backlash. You have to be well aware of what your actions are going, what the counteraction is to your action. I mean, we just saw this last week, a lot of counter reaction that was more powerful than we expected.
Sure.
But we have to be able to get our message across without actually activating somebody's medulla oblongata. Am I saying
medulla oblongata?
There we go.
Matata.
Hakuna Matata.
What a wonderful phrase.
Yes. well, and then, Ron John, you've taken up the parenting mantle
with
aplomb and vigor, of which I have not seen in some time. What would your positioning on this one be?
It's interesting you mentioned that my role as a parent, and the reason why is because I know that there was a time in my life where I'd be like, we need to support this team. We need to support the organization. So we need to support the after school Satan clubs. We need to support. Shining a harsher and more skeptical light on what happens in the good news clubs. And we definitely need to shine a similarly harsher and more skeptical light on the sort of free reign that evangelical and religious church Christian organizations have in utilizing public accommodations in schools.
Right.
The other side of that is that the playing field, the terrain of this argument is kids.
Right.
Like, it's like this entire argument like lives on top of children. Mm. And that's a very challenging place to put an argument and expect it not to at some point or another become really emotional, mm-hmm. because all of the players are either people who want clubs in these schools or parents.
Right.
None of the players are actually the kids.
I don't know that that's necessarily true. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody who's been to a Camp Quest Northwest camp, a camper, mm-hmm. might be involved in making this happen. Like, I know people who are involved, campers involved in Camp Quest Northwest are starting up SSA affiliates in their high schools.
But an SSA affiliate I consider an SSA affiliate within, let me back up. The people who want an SSA affiliate in an educational institution as a club are making an affirmative decision to that's about having secular discussions.
Right.
The Satanist, I apologize. I'm using the word Satanist. I mean Satan clubs, and I really worry about using the wrong terminology here. But the Satan clubs and the Satanic Temple are not about that kind of affirmative statement, particularly when they're putting clubs into schools specifically chosen because they have good news clubs.
Right.
It is deliberately designed as a provocative antagonistic statement and a provocative antagonistic action.
We were both fairly antagonistic students once upon a time, though.
Yes.
Yeah,
we were. But that was largely as like grade school, like middle schoolers and high schoolers.
Right.
I think as primary school, I mean, because this is an elementary school.
Right.
Like K through 5 education.
Is it K through 5 here?
Yeah, elementary is like K through 4, K through 5
okay.
usually. Yeah. So K through 4, K through 5, that's not going to be like a hotbed of, I mean, granted, I mean, I was sent to the principal's office for like not letting science class start because Dean Macbeth seemed to think that Iran-Contra wasn't a big deal because, hey, it's war. What are you going to do?
Right.
And I was like, no, we're not. Mr. Schultz, we cannot start science class because this idiot refuses to get on board with law. And so, no, we're going to talk about this. And I was like kicked out of class and sent to Mr. Meyer's office, principal's office, because I was being disruptive. And that was like fifth grade.
Right.
So I get that.
Right.
There may be kids who are like that. And if there are, then, you know, yay, more power to them. But it's unusual to find that kind of disruptive activism. And it would actually be really challenging, I think, in today's classrooms with the testing pressure, with the performance pressure in a K through 12, in like a fourth grade or a fifth grade classroom. I think it would be very challenging to see that.
Right.
I think in a first through third grade or a K through 3 type classroom, it would be almost unheard of.
Yeah, I think the middle ground, as Josh points out, might be the way to go. Mm-hmm. I think I'm definitely going to reach out to them. If it makes it to ask an atheist, I think I'm going to, all right, why do religious people involve children in a lot of this political crap? Because children are hard to attack. It's not that they're an irrefutable argument. They're an argument you don't want to have because it's going to automatically make you look like a bully.
Or you can throw whatever intent you want on them. So like,
right.
It's just as easy for us to say that there might be a kid who's involved in this and then use that within the context of the argument to say, well, so then it's actually okay because a kid wants this.
Right.
Right? It's just, and a similar argument, I think, is probably made by the Good News Club by the Good News Club folks to say, well, the kids really enjoy the club. So what are you going to do? Are you going to go ahead and tell the kids that they can't have this? What's next? Satan? What's next? Santa?
Right.
The Tooth Fairy? You're the Killjoy.
Right.
Right.
I got no problem being a Killjoy.
Well,
I've just become comfortable with that.
There is this.
Yeah.
We actually just very recently, and this has nearly nothing to do with this. We just like this last week popped the Tooth Fairy balloon with our 9-year-old.
Okay.
Oh wow.
And
yeah.
Yeah. and that was really tough. And I was really worried about it. My wife, their mom, was really worried about it. Our 9-year-old just was fine. She was like, "Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I get it."
You have a fairly devious 9-year-old.
Well, there is that, right.
So,
but we've given her a mission.
You've conned me? That's fantastic.
That's right.
Yeah.
But the thing is, she rolled with it the way we wanted her to roll with it, which was, okay, so now it's my job to keep the spirit alive. And so we're preparing her. Our goal here is to prepare her the same way we prepared her 15-year-old brother when he found out that, when we told him that Satan, when we told him that Satan wasn't real. Really? Really? That Satan wasn't real? When we told him that Santa wasn't real, this is not a helpful like mnemonic, but when we told him that Santa wasn't real, the transition was Santa's real and that's how Christmas happens to Santa's not real, you're how Christmas happens.
Okay.
And so the transition isn't from like there's no Santa, it's from there's Santa to there's no Santa.
Mm-hmm.
It's from there's Santa to you are Santa.
Yeah.
And I think that mission is interesting, is an interesting place to land, as opposed to this sort of like nihilistic, there's nothing to believe in thing.
Well, I think that particular function right there, we'll talk about the Santa thing for a couple minutes, but I do want to get back to the Satan.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah.
is, I think that's how I transitioned from Christmas being my favorite holiday to Thanksgiving being my favorite holiday.
Because it's very much about yourself.
Yeah, and I just realized the enormous amounts of stress my parents were under to try to make Christmas Christmas. It's like, wait, that's lame. Like literally, my parents are running scared trying to make Christmas work. This sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just eat a huge turkey and relax and watch a sport none of us like?
Right.
That seems a lot more relaxing and a lot more fun.
And a lot cheaper.
A lot cheaper.
Yeah, yeah, right. There's no wrapping. You don't have to go on the annual hunt for scotch tape in the house. Yeah.
All right. So Satan. So I mean, part of it is I have an advantage here in that a certain other host of this show is, in fact, an educator who focused for many years on about this age of kid.
Mm-hmm.
Becky teaches high school now, but she originally teached late elementary, junior high.
She would say taught.
Taught.
Yeah.
Whatever. She's not in the room.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. God, let me have my small moments of linguistic freedom.
All right. Okay, fine. Fine. Sam, you done learned me.
Thank you. thank you kindly. So she ain't teaching the young kids anymore.
we're just going to fly in the face of it. I love it.
Yeah. If I were to involve, if we're doing this on Ask an Atheist, we're going to cover this on Ask an Atheist. If the kids are going to be involved, which would be interesting,
mm-hmm,
if they I want them positively involved. I want the kid to say, I'd like to talk about this on the air.
Right.
Or not on the air now, on the podcast.
Right.
I'm not going to say, would you like to, I'm not going to try and sell it like some
go and
goods.
Find like, yeah, yeah, right.
Two, the parents are going to have to be positively involved in that, mm-hmm, as well. And then three, if I'm going to assist in this after school Satan club, I offer you, it's a thing I learned in doing community organizing here in sort of the balkanized atheist groups of the Pacific Northwest, which is you offer a set of benefits and you say, yeah, it's an invitation,
right,
not a demand. Mm-hmm. Here's a thing I can do. If this works for you, say yes. And
right,
a lot of times I end up saying no.
Right.
But
you're providing a platform or a marketplace,
yeah,
as opposed to like saying like, we have an agenda and we'd like you to participate in that.
Pretty much.
Right.
So, good thing, bad thing. Josh, how do you foresee this all ending here in Tacoma? Do you think we're going to have, do you think we're going to end up having any demonstrations or arguments or loud screaming like we did with methanol?
The escalation that's going to happen, again, I'm going to bring up the counter reaction that we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
it just depends on how that escalates. We would be fine with no Satan clubs.
Right.
If that meant no good news clubs.
Right.
And that's really the objective. But the good news club is economically viable for a lot of people. And so I don't see that going away.
But do you think the honey trap would be sprung here, where the after-school Satan club gets banned, but the good news club remains? I mean, do you see that actually happening here under these circumstances?
I could see it being attempted, but no, I don't see it succeeding.
I could see it. I don't think it'll happen, and the reason I don't think it'll happen is because the people who actually have a dog in this hunt include the educators. Like, the educators themselves would never allow this to become disruptive to education. And
I don't know that's necessarily true, because good news clubs in certain areas, including places around here, have already become disruptive to education. Educators feel like it sort of as a professional courtesy that they kind of have to stay out of this fight a lot of the time. And that has the second order effect of blowing this stuff way out of proportion sometimes, because educators don't do something. They don't say something. They don't make a deal out of it. They stay out of it.
They kind of try to steer clear of it. And because they try to steer clear of it, folks,
every side views it as something to argue about. Usually as an olive branch to the other side, I find.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Because nobody's making a thing out of it, they feel like their opportunity, they're losing the opportunity to be provocative.
Yeah.
And so, like, the Satan clubs themselves may become more, they may become more agitational,
right,
in order to get the attention that they want.
Right.
And that could definitely be disruptive. I think I want to watch how this one plays out. My thing is honestly always going to be, like, you know, how disruptive are they going to be to the school?
Right.
And how disruptive are the good news clubs then going to, are the good news clubs going to change in their level of disruption of the school as an educational environment?
So we have a fork in the path here. We can continue talking about kids, or we could continue talking about Satan. My vote's kids.
Sure.
All right. Here we go then.
I'll take kids for 200.
A survey of parents in the United Kingdom found nearly a quarter of parents feared that passing their religious beliefs onto their children result in kids being alienated at school. Just over a quarter of parents weren't bothering to pass on their religion because their children might have questions they, the parents, could not answer. And a third felt that that social media would have more of an impact on their children's beliefs than their own parental input. While many parents were concerned that their children would not grow up to share their faith, 18% reported that it was not their role as a parent to pass their beliefs to their children. The survey included parents who were Christian and irreligious in about equal numbers, with a smaller percentage of respondents from other religions. Well, statement one for me is, boy, this is not the United States.
Yeah. The idea that social media is going to be a stronger impact on kids is a fascinating one, I think, given the fact that we tend to shelter kids a lot more here from social media.
Yeah.
I think the other piece of it is being able to find parents, both Christian parents and irreligious parents, in about equal numbers. That's hard to do here. You'd have to kind of go out of state or bust them in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting thing. I actually, but there's another piece of it that's kind of in the back of my head. This idea that parents are just sort of like giving up. They're like, well, we can't take responsibility for this because we're not enough of a factor in the way that our kids are raised,
right,
to be able to have an opinion on this. And to which I say, like, that's horse hockey. That's total. Can I say it?
No, just go horse hockey.
Or horse hockey. Okay.
Yeah. Because that's funnier.
Right. Horse hockey. Horse hockey. Sorry. All of you MASH fans out there, it's a little throwback. this notion that parents aren't going to have a role to play in how their kids are raised with regard to interacting with and joining or considering their membership in the institution of religion, I don't buy it. That strikes me as an answer on a survey, not an actual decision.
Yeah, because your actions as a religious person are going to be pushed on your child, especially if you're going to actually attend church. If you're religious, that's the assumption. That's going to have an influence on your children. So it's easy to check off on a survey that basically you're not going to influence your child, but every action you do, either religious or irreligious, is going to be influential.
I think it's nice. I think there's a real answer there. I think the social media aspect of it, saying that, you know what, social media, the fact that we're more, that there's sort of an ever-present public conversation going on that includes religion, and that's going to have a huge influence on mm-hmm. my child's beliefs. I think that's a meaningful statement.
Yeah.
And I think that when you say, wow, social media is going to be way more influential on my kid, probably in the long run, than I am, because at some point they're going to move out, and it's not like they move out of social media.
Right.
I think that's a meaningful statement. I think there's a there.
But also, the thing about social media is that social media feeds off of your predilections anyway. You start a bubble based off of your influences and your actual beliefs.
Yeah.
It reinforces it. So that's still going to probably be working in the favor of, if it's a religious parent, it'll work in the favor of their belief. And if they're irreligious, then the same thing.
A thing that I've been telling people in person, but not on social media, because nobody will ever read it, is that social media is designed to put you with like-minded people and to put you away from people who think differently from you.
Right.
And so the way if you were to look at my Facebook wall right now, you would think there's like maybe 3 religious people left in the United States.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's clearly not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that had effects in this. Oh, let's break the seal. The
election.
The election.
I was wondering, like, are we going to pivot into this? But you're right. You're absolutely right. We've all been in a bubble that really contains a self-created bubble, a self-curated bubble that contains a bunch of people who agree with us. Diversity, I think, in social media is usually limited to, oh, there's people I did not know who also agree with me.
Right.
So it's not diversity of ideas.
You know, I'm not going to make it vague. I'm going to get specific. There's a there's a person I had this conversation with on Facebook about 8 or 10 months ago now, Valerie Tirico, mm-hmm. who we both know. She writes for everything,
right.
It feels like. You know, she's very active, does a whole lot of stuff, and mm-hmm. she's posting about it all on her Facebook page. Valerie Tirico is great. So if it sounds like I'm being antagonistic towards her, that is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I warned, because originally that's what she thought mm-hmm. I was doing. And that's I saw over a course of on one Saturday I saw her writing something about her dislike, let's not say disdain, that's too strong, of Bernie Sanders supporters, you know, the whole Bernie bro concept.
Mm-hmm.
She did it in a different way again a week later, and I saw that one too. And those are the only two things from Valerie Tirico I saw on my Facebook wall.
Mm. So it just feels like she's got this, she's beating this drum.
And I said so. And I said, right. The only two things I've seen on my Facebook wall from you in the last couple weeks are two things about Bernie Bros. And she's like, that's ridiculous. I've done so much. How dare you say that? And I'm like, no. My point. You found it. I know from back channel information from other sources that you're working constantly, that you're doing, you're producing articles, you're talking to people, you're helping people out, but from my Facebook wall,
right.
It looks like this is all you're saying, and I think that's a meaningful thing to point out.
Right. So there's like a Facebook-generated homunculus of her,
right.
That's limited to this particular topic.
Right.
And so it's frequent posting of this one topic results in the perception of a trend, but that perception of a trend is entirely based on curation. It's not based on like actual activity.
Yeah.
All right. But this doesn't even stop at social media. This is how the internet has been kind of evolved. The Google has the same tendencies. It still is built upon your search history.
Right.
So if you have liberal tendencies, those are going to be what populate on your feeds or your search results first. So,
yeah, it's like I look for statistical data about the 2016 election, and I get articles about Arch Linux, and it's like well, thank you for knowing what distribution I run, Mr. Google, but I'm actually looking for statistical data about the election. That's totally a thing, and one of the things that I think we should be talking about more that we're not, because a lot of people are shocked at the way things turn out, the way votes turn out, the way what social response to things are, because we think we're more connected, and we all are more connected, but we're more connected just to more like-minded people. We're not actually to become
right.
more connected with the larger population, with everybody, requires a lot of work that a lot of us just aren't doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's meaningful.
Right. And it's, I think when we try to diversify that, a lot of times we try to diversify that by consuming a wider variety of content.
It's good.
But it's not really about connecting with a wider variety of people.
Right.
And so since social media is largely driven by the people you connect with, not the content you consume, even if you, like, spontaneously deciding you're going to do nothing but read the Wall Street Journal editorial page isn't going to add conservative voices to your Facebook feed.
Right.
It might change your ad profile, but it's not going to change your social profile.
Right.
And I think that's a critical gap. And I don't know how to solve that. I love stumbling into people who disagree with me politically, partly because they're rare, and that's another sort of characteristic of this engine that we use to connect with people now. But also because when I have those conversations, very seldom, when I meet those people, very seldom am I meeting them in a context where we can throw down. You know, I'm meeting them at work. You know, it's like, we're not going to, oh my God, you're a Trump voter? Let's do this. It's like, no, we actually have a project plan to discuss. Also, this is work. What the hell?
I was going to ask you about that, which is, I mean, you're going to school right now, but you're going to an online school, are you not, Josh?
Actually, no, I graduated.
Oh, you did?
May, so.
Oh, wow. My clock continues to be broken.
This daylight saving time.
Yeah. It's
El Nino.
We set back our clocks to, well, as it happens, 2000. but you were also in the military, so you got, and that's a little, that's not a, that's a very different kind of self-selecting population when you start talking about.
It's actually going to probably get worse for me because I just took another job with the DOD.
Oh, no kidding.
So I'm reinserting myself into that bubble.
And yeah.
I'm going to be the one blue part of the big red bubble.
I always kind of, from working for a contractor who worked with the government and from living near, you know, JBLM, I've always just sort of gotten the sense that it's a very conservative, very religious area of human interaction. Is that actually true? I mean, is that part of the self-selection?
It's extremely true.
There
is still an abundant liberal presence within the military, but the thing is that I was trained from day one in the military to always vote Republican if I wanted a pay raise. That's actually what drill sergeants will tell inductees, will tell soldiers in training, because the perception is that Republicans are good for your bottom line, even though that you're more likely to be on food stamps while deployed to Iraq.
Right.
Or you're more likely to be deployed. You're more likely to be on food stamps, but base pay might increase or base funding might increase. But like pay to individuals doesn't generally increase.
Yeah, there's a lot I could say about that, but that quickly expands beyond.
But the PX will be so much prettier under a Republican administration.
The thing is, you'll have better weapons, you'll have better tools at your disposal, but the thing is, that does not reflect on actual pay scale increases.
So far, we have come away. It's like I read the news brief for this thing in the UK and just went, or, you know, off in a completely different direction, but that's kind of my point here, and the commentary on what I have to say about this news brief is not just in what we said, but it's in how we said it. This news brief may as well be talking about Martians to me right today. I have no idea what living in that world would look like. I'd have to go over there and forget that I'm American for about
a there's
year.
A huge, I mean, it, making the distinction between the U.S. and the U.K. in terms of religion is a massive undertaking. I mean, you know, there's a state religion. There's a figurehead God representative within government.
Right.
Right. They're billionaires.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a huge number of distinctions to be made between religious context in social and public life in the UK versus the same institutions and how we interact with them here in the United States. I think that's a big part of that also is the fact that because there is this publicly funded religious institution, people are much less likely to take it on themselves to get all religious because there's an office for that. Like they do that. They do that for a living. And so we don't have to go and so the English public or the British public doesn't actually have to get wound up about religion because they pay taxes for that.
So while talking about a survey in religion in the UK with kids, the salient point to take away from Ask an Atheist is beware of social media. Because that makes sense.
Right.
Because, you know, watch out for self-selecting populations, because it doesn't, your self-selecting population may not be representative of the population at large. Speaking of self-selecting populations, the Humanists of Washington and Seattle Atheists, along with the University Unitarian Humanists, cordially invite freethinkers and their families and friends from Seattle and beyond to celebrate the coming winter solstice at our annual solstice potluck on Saturday, December 10th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the University Unitarian Church in Seattle. This year, we are encouraging attendees to bring new socks to donate to Treehouse, an organization benefiting foster youth in the greater Seattle area. Children are a welcome and essential part of the celebration. We'll have some craft activities for them and welcome teens who wish to help facilitate and assist with us. For more information, visit humanistsofwashington.org or seattleatheists.org. I know that was pretty cold of me to do, but...
No, it's I love that event. It continues to be one of the events that I actually always go to.
It's
every
one
year.
Of my favorite events, too.
Yeah, it's yeah. A super...
Even when I'm not cooking.
Right, it's yeah. Super fun. You get to meet everybody, and I think you're raising a fair point that... that the individual organizations, even that represent, you know, the balkanized pieces of free thought within the Puget Sound,
yeah,
and the Pacific Northwest, mixing them all together once a year as we do, and at the solstice dinner, is a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, and I it's like, my point is, don't just go with self-selecting populations, but you need to have your friends too, and. Mm-hmm. Okay, I like my bleak jokes, and going from the social media conversation directly into the solstice thing is my idea of a bleak joke, but it is very much a great event, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really glad it's back this year, because I missed it terribly last year.
Definitely. Please come.
Yeah, this is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we will talk about that thing you have been expecting us to talk about.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. I want to bring it back, but it's
more than basic. Ask an Atheist may have gone on the road, but we're not making big bucks.
We still need to keep the lights on, and 95% of our costs are for airtime alone.
That's why we need your contributions.
If you've got something to advertise, consider Ask an Atheist in your ad budget.
Our listener Peggy said it best. Step up and contribute to keep secular voices on the air. For $5, you could have a latte or a moment of science.
Take on Peggy's challenge and contribute today.
For details, go to askanatheist.tv or contribute directly via PayPal to paypal@askanatheist.tv.
48 hours. 24 hours. 10 minutes to go.
Motorcade appears to have stopped, and yes, it appears as though the governor is getting out now. It's hard to see. My God, the rain is, it's coming down in sheets. I've never seen anything like this. There must be tens of thousands of people out here right now. The streets are shut down. Okay, it appears the governor is making his way toward the convention center. No one knows what he's going to say. The crowd is pushing forward through the storm. The Secret Service is struggling to hold them back. A wave of people are rushing toward the candidate. My God.
Zero. For your consideration, we present Convention and its subject, the nominee, ANNEXradio.com, now on iTunes and Stitcher.
My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTF Pod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait a minute, not sacrificing children, that's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTF Pod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
I really hate the word unprecedented. I'm sick of the word unprecedented. Nothing that you have seen in the last 14 days could even come close to being described as unprecedented. We have seen it all before. In the 19th century. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying there's a precedent. Because the precedent I think we're seeing, looking at right now is Zachary Taylor. Who is a populist president who was elected by an anti-war party who was a general in the Mexican-American War. I think that's the right one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he said, I hold no allegiance to anything ever. And the Whigs, who were very much against the war, said, well, he's popular. Let's go for him. And he won.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a terrible job. And he destroyed the Whig Party. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Oh, there's an interesting little coda to that story. It's called the American Civil War. Just putting that out there. And today I have to announce a kind of major shift in the show. The gloves are coming off. I'm not being secretive about any aspect of my personality anymore. But let's talk about, like I said, let's break the seal. This is November 15th, 14th? What is it? I don't know. Someone
it's in
the 13th. It's 13th. The 13th. I don't know. Screw time. it's the week. It is the episode after the 2016 presidential election in the United States. And I have to say the words that I'm going to try to say as few times as possible. We are living under the umbrella of the president-elect Donald Trump. Which a lot of people don't like.
Let me pour you a glass of bleach to gargle.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm going to have a lot to say that I've been saying privately and sometimes on Facebook that I haven't been saying on the show because, one, I didn't think it was appropriate, and two, I didn't want it to be true.
Yeah.
This isn't a case of I told you so. This is a case of I didn't say, and I wish I was wrong. I wanted the things I was thinking to be wrong. I wanted the kind of world that my friends were trying to say that we lived in was the world that we lived in. I wanted the kind of world that I grew up in, where I had to worry about people hating other people and having that be the central tenet of their politics. That world was over. Not precisely the world we live in. It seems like it's the world I thought it was. And desperately hoped I was wrong about.
And kind of didn't want to jinx it.
I didn't want to jinx it.
There's a certain amount of this. It's just like, I think I'm worried about this, and I don't want anyone to think that this is a real thing and then latch onto it.
I don't want to be proven wrong. I want to be proven wrong. Right. It's like, this is like, a lot of people say, oh, I hate being proven wrong. So much of American society, so much of the atheist discourse mm-hmm. is based off of the idea that people really hate being wrong. They want to be right all the time. I don't want it. There's a lot of things that I think that I don't want to be right about, and this was one of them. And I'm not saying I predicted this outcome. I did not. But I knew that the kind of people that we, that may have made this decision what it was, were out there, and were voting. And were voting the way I thought they would. And I have been thinking a lot of thoughts, and I'm not even really certain where to begin. There's a hard entry. It's hard to find an entry point on something that, from a social media aspect and from just a talking to other people aspect, is so massive. I mean, it's like a bomb's gone off out there. It's like people have been describing it like someone has died. Mm-hmm. There is a mourning phase going right now, and if you need to mourn, you go do that. I'm not playing the you're weak if you can't deal with this card. I might say some kind of aggressive sounding things, but this is a bad time. Like I said, gloves off. And everybody out there, you do what you need to do to cope with the world that you live in. But let's not pretend that this isn't the world that we live in.
Right. So get comfortable with it. Do what you need to do in order to get comfortable with it.
No.
But don't.
Do not get comfortable with this.
No,
this
I mean, is... don't. Okay, let me rephrase. Get on board with recognizing that this is a real challenge. This is a real situation that needs to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And it either needs to be dealt with comfort, or it needs to be dealt with by fighting against it.
Yeah.
But you don't have an option of still being on the fence about whether or not we have a contingent within this country that's okay with misogyny, okay with racism, if it comes with a set of plans or a policy portfolio that benefits them financially or benefits their kids financially.
And that's the kind of thinking that I think is the problem.
Okay. Well, then I'm glad I teed that up.
Because in the break, Josh, you had some interesting facts to say about the election, that Donald Trump won with less votes than Mitt Romney received when he lost in 2012.
Yeah, this was an extremely low turnout election. Hillary was counting on turning out the vote, but her entire campaign was ran on Trump is evil, Trump is bad, elect me because at least I'm the status quo.
Yeah.
And that did not turn out the vote at all.
Right.
We won the popular vote, but we didn't win the key states. And in fact, for me, the realization that it was going to be a loss was watching Florida turn into such a battle state. The expectation that was going to be actually handily won by Hillary.
Right.
And then also then the Rust Belt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of it's malcontent against the concept of the status quo. Nobody is happy with what the economic situation is, because one, the perception of the economic situation might not reflect reality, but also doesn't reflect it for the middle and low class.
Right. If you've been listening to the show for the last 6 years, I think you have an idea of the kind of world that I would like, that I have been advocating for, and the kind of world that I like. And if the last 6 years of me talking hasn't convinced you that there's a very specific kind of world that I like, and it's a very open world, and it's a very accepting world, and it's a world where all sorts of identities, sexual and otherwise, have the freedom to exist, or, you know, where religion doesn't dominate, where people's hatred of each other doesn't dominate, where racism doesn't dominate, where misogyny doesn't dominate. If you don't believe that's the kind of world that I want, it's time to turn off your podcast catcher and to find another show. Because I'm about to say something. I have to say this now. I feel like that I don't even know how to connect this with what I want to say. The problem is the kind of politics that we in the atheism community have adopted, and that have adopted in the wider world, and I'm talking about the politics of shame. So much of the 2016 election cycle, from my end of the political spectrum, has been the politics of shame. Shame casting is what I've taken to calling it. Is if you vote for Trump, you're shame. If you don't support Hillary, you should feel shame because you're a misogynist. If you don't vote precisely the way I vote, you should feel shame. It's the casting of shame. It's the shame as the stick with no carrot in this political spectrum. And we've shamed a lot of people in saying, you know, he's a racist, he's a sexist, he's a misogynist, he literally grabs women by the genitals and thinks that's an okay to do, and he says that in front of a live mic, either accidentally on Access Hollywood or intentionally on the Howard Stern show. And if you support that kind of thing, you should feel shame. Now go into this room where we can't see you and vote precisely the way I told you, otherwise you will feel shame. That didn't work. It didn't work at all. Most people just said, I'm just not going to do it because both these choices suck. But not only that, we have to look at the numbers here. And the numbers say a lot of women, well, a lot of white women, but also, you know, women of a lot of women voted for Donald Trump. A lot of Latino voters went for Donald Trump. Not in the majority in their groups, but they all contributed to his win. Do you think that population of people are racists and misogynists? Are they the white men that you fear? Clearly not. We have to break bread with these people. We need to figure out why they voted for Trump. We need to figure out what went. We need to adapt our strategy, is what I'm saying, is that our strategy has manifestly failed. It didn't work. And it's time to manifest that stuff. It's time to manifest a new strategy. It's time to put together something else. Like I was saying in the previous segment, we've insisted ourselves. We've surrounded ourselves by like-minded people. We don't. Technology has been developed to make it very easy to make it feel like we're reaching thousands and millions of people when really we're reaching tens and hundreds. And we're not reaching as many people as we thought, me included. And we thought these politics were working. But I've seen people talk who were voting for Trump. I'm I know a lot of Trump voters because I've sought them out because I want to know how their brains work. And I know that some of their choices were based off of, I have been told I should feel shame for these things. None of what they're talking about helps me in any way. And I don't think it helps a lot of other people. So I'm voting for Trump because I would rather hit the machine with a sledgehammer than try to fix it. And I think that's what we got.
I get the idea of wanting change and therefore voting for Trump, but I don't...
Or not voting.
But wanting change is an affirmative thing. It's not as destructive, I think, as I think we want to frame it. I think voting for Trump is not an affirmative act. I think voting for Trump is saying that you're gonna throw a Lego set in the air and hope it comes down like a space shuttle.
Did you just take intelligent design argument? Did you just make an intelligent design argument?
Not accidentally.
Okay.
I mean, but I make a distinction between wanting change and expecting change from a random act of destruction. I think those are two completely different things. Wanting change is not synonymous with expecting Trump to deliver it. I think those are two completely
No, absolutely.
Things.
I think this was a more long-term decision, is that there's a machine that they don't like, and they thought, of the two choices, this is the
Right,
is
if I have to choose,
yeah.
If I'm told my duty is to choose, if the cast of the Avengers is going to come on TV and tell me that I have to choose,
right.
I'm not going to choose the woman that really knows the system well. I'm going to choose the guy who says that he hates the system too.
Right.
Because that's a stronger affinity.
They elected a political arsonist. They want to see the system as the status quo burn.
Yeah.
It's essentially came down to lackluster support because this Hillary Clinton was absolutely the establishment candidate. She was not going to affect the change that people perceived that was necessary. So they went with the political arsonist.
I think the political arson. I think that is the most succinct way I think I've heard it put in so far.
Yeah. So Dave Chappelle called him an internet. He said we elected an internet troll.
He's Genghis Khan.
We totally elected an internet troll.
Right.
We absolutely did.
I want to make sure that we're characterizing this, or at least I want to insert into this a sort of a caveat. We are talking about like all of these arguments about why people voted for Hillary Clinton or didn't vote for Hillary Clinton or voted for Trump or didn't vote for Trump are based, like at least the arguments we're using here are based largely on low information voters. It's not based on data. Like no one's looking at Trump's policy portfolio and comparing it to Hillary Clinton's policy portfolio.
There's
and
a
saying,
policy portfolio?
Well, no.
There is.
No,
totally is. I've read it.
There is, but
it's not.
It's not
great.
Thick.
Yeah.
Right. It's not thick. It's not great.
Literally,
it's not well
I'm going to be
out.
The greatest. We're going to have the greatest military. That's not a policy.
No, he doesn't refer to what's the policy portfolio on his website in his speech is because that's boring and nobody wants to listen to. I mean, this is he's running. He ran his campaign like an advertising campaign.
Well, yeah. And so
he kept the details out.
Well, I was. And so during the break, we were talking about, about Donald Trump as a populist, and I actually push back against that. I don't believe that he's a populist. I believe he was popular. He ran a student council campaign.
Okay.
He wants the wall for the same reason the football quarterback wants to be your student council president, because you all want bigger slices of pizza. I want bigger slices of pizza for you too.
Yeah.
It's like I know I can't do anything about bigger slices of pizza.
There are not enough high sugar sodas in the vending machine.
Exactly. And the price needs to be down. Like, we need to reduce the price of vending machine of the vending machine soda. It's like, well, the student council president doesn't have anything to do with that. But you want that, I want that, therefore I'm your guy. Whether I can do anything about that has nothing to do with anything. But that's a popular argument. It's different from being a populist.
Right.
A populist is a policy portfolio. And I don't think Donald Trump had a sufficiently populist policy portfolio.
Right.
I think he had an extraordinarily popular.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk populist campaign, which you're calling a popular campaign, mm-hmm. We can talk demagoguery, but, I don't think we had any actual between the two likely choices to be president, between the two real choices for the presidency, we didn't have a populist. We didn't have a populist candidate. We didn't have somebody who was... saying things about the nature of the economy and wanting to change the economy. Mm-hmm. You know, we had two candidates who liked the system as it is just fine. But one of them was clearly, one of them was an efficient administrator of that system with more experience than literally anybody else in the United States at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was a yutz who said, you know, it's, you're sure you could run that system, but the system sucks. We need a new one.
Right.
And a bunch of terrible stuff besides. And that's how that vote turned out.
I admit, this is like I think this is the longest conversation I've had about the election since the election.
Me too.
And I've been pretty quiet about it. I've been kind of staying away from the news. The first day I thought I could listen. Actually, immediately after the election, I stopped listening to the news because my morning routine is to listen to NPR. So I stopped listening to the news and I started listening to KEXP. So I was listening to music for a little bit in the morning, and then the next day I was listening to music. And then I had to stop listening to music because Leonard Cohen died.
Right.
And I was like, well, my mood is really not compatible with like all of Leonard Cohen right now.
Right.
So thanks a lot, KEXP. I couldn't even do that. Never mind, KEXP. We love you. but it was incredibly hard. Like this morning, I decided to listen to the news, and I was able to make it through like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was listening to NPR interview a Trump voter who was super upset about who was super excited about immigration changing and realizing he was talking about my parents.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Right. I was like, okay, your guy won.
That brings us into the we should be afraid given all the things that he said, but let's talk about the huge list of things that Trump has already walked back even before his first meeting with Obama. He walked back the wall.
Mm-hmm.
He walked back the war on coal. He walked back mass deportations,
mm-hmm.
and is now limited to just people with criminal records. He's walked back...
Yeah, it went from like 11 million to like 2 million or something.
Right.
Yeah.
He walked back...
Still no way to do that, by the way.
Yeah, still no way to do that.
Right.
Yeah. You know, he walked back completely destroying Obamacare.
Right.
There's so much... But I think the important point here is he's president, not king.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a limited amount of stuff that he's going to be able to do. That doesn't mean there isn't going to be damage. There's going to be, I imagine there's going to be quite some damage. I mean, let's talk about who he picked for the EPA.
Literally don't know.
Climate change denier.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, okay.
Because that's what you do. That's what they did in the George W. Bush era.
Right. Yeah. The UN ambassador is going to be a person who doesn't believe in the UN. So, of course, the guy who runs EPA is going to be a person who doesn't believe in the EPA.
Right. Right.
I want to basically be optimistic. I want to say focus on all the elections. Stop focusing on presidential. We lost the ground game of this.
So, all right, the first thing I need to say is that there are definitely racists. There are definitely misogynists. There are definitely fascists who came out for this one. I'm not saying these people don't exist. On YouTube, one of the videos I recently posted about a month ago was I reposted somebody who found a copy of Christopher Hitchens talking to the 90s style kinder face of racism. I mm-hmm. don't know if you remember those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody found of him on Book TV or something like that, talking to one of these guys and his dad, who was way worse, on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing episode. I'll post a link to it. The only reason I posted it myself is because the audio was inaudible, so I cleaned up the audio. Had it fill the available bandwidth and then reposted it and then said, here, this guy posted it. I'm fixing it. Those people exist. Right now, I'm really concerned about the future of marriage equality, because mm-hmm. that's at risk here. I mean, marriage equality wasn't... It wasn't a popular thing. It was done by the Supreme Court, and now the Supreme Court is going to have a different
makeup,
right?
Yeah, different constituents.
Roe is another one.
Yeah, Roe scares me a little bit more because Trump is not the problem here.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Pence is the problem. No, Mike Pence is blunted because of his vice presidency. I mean, he's not the guy in charge. He's the guy sitting next to the guy in charge.
But the guy in charge just said that he's going to be in the office like 5 days a week, and
but
then he's going to bust a move for Florida.
We've seen this before. This is 2004 all over again.
With, like, President Vacation.
With President Vacation and right. Vice President Evil.
Right.
And a word I only use in jest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, in the short things that I've been able to say about this election since it actually happened, I think Thursday morning, I was like, honestly, I almost feel like the best possible thing that could happen is if Trump decided to name Dick Cheney as his chief of staff. Like, the level of competence that would bring to the, like, that would be the only thing that might make this better. Is because now it's like you've got Pence, and Pence is going to bring his policy portfolio. That's fine. But at least if we could have some competence, if we could actually have somebody who knows how to run the damn office.
And someone who has drifted significantly on things like marriage equality.
Right.
Because
you've got marriage equality because of his daughter.
Yeah.
Legalizing marijuana is fully in keeping with get off my lawn Wyoming conservatism.
Right.
So there are a number of things where even Dick Cheney might be a better approach.
Yeah.
And Dick Cheney's competence at running an office as a former Secretary of Defense, as a former Chief of Staff, as the Vice President, and essentially the most powerful Vice President we've ever had, I think that would have actually been a good thing.
Yeah.
And that's a terrifying thing to say, that Dick Cheney is a step up.
Right.
Because there has previously never really been space below Dick Cheney.
No. No, there hasn't.
Right.
And now there is.
Right. Yes. to co-opt John Oliver's own thing that he stole from himself repeatedly about, like, we have reached rock bottom.
Yeah.
And then he'd be like, a week ago I said we reached rock bottom. Yeah. And then a week ago, and then be like, a week ago I said a week ago we reached rock bottom.
Fair.
Like, every single week he was like, it's getting further and further down.
So, but the thing is, my preface is, these people exist. They came out in numbers that we haven't seen In a while,
yeah.
And what I've always said about technology is, like, a lot of people say, oh my God, there are so many more racists, da 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 da. It's like, no, they've always been here. They've always been a part of the American conversation. The technology has just gotten so good that you can see them now.
Right. Or the technology has been, or the social media, the communications methods that we use in order to escape from mass media.
Yeah.
So, like, there's mass media and social media. Mass media now exposes more of that stuff, so it feels like it happens more often.
Right.
Like, car chases happen more often. No, they don't. But when there's a car chase in Atlanta, CNN calls it breaking news and tells the world about it.
Right.
Child abductions, less frequent, but that doesn't stop parents from being more terrified about it.
And now, yeah, we all get our phones beep every time somebody is kidnapped.
In Spokane.
Somebody is kidnapped in Spokane. My phone
goes Amber Alert and makes a noise.
The emergency broadcast system noise.
Right.
And tells me that they're kidnapped and keep an eye out for it. Our panopticon has gotten so good that we see a lot more violence and a lot more bad stuff than we ever have previously at a time where a lot of this stuff is
happening less often. Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So these people exist, but that cannot be the people who elected Trump. It wasn't solely these people who elected Trump. That's the takeaway here, is if you just say everybody who voted for Trump is a racist and a misogynist and you know, whatever and whatever and whatever, any bad word you can throw at him, this is what we're going to have for the rest of our freaking lives.
Yes.
Because we're going to ignore them, because if we ignore them, they're going to ignore us, and they can still win elections. And it's not an age thing, it's an ideology thing. And the way to approach that is to go to work, not just...
So you're arguing against othering racists?
No.
I'm sort of being sarcastic there, but I actually genuinely think that's probably the right move. Like, othering racists means we can't ever talk to them.
Right.
Because we don't acknowledge their humanity, we don't acknowledge their ability to actually be agents in their own lives.
I guess my argument is, in a popular democracy, or in a popular republic, you kind of have to talk to these people if you want to win sometimes.
Right.
You gotta, I mean, it's the strange bedfellows argument. It's stupid, but that's, we decided to not have strange bedfellows for an election cycle, and look what we got.
Right.
And I think it's time to admit that. And I don't say, no, racists are marginalized, even within conservative communities.
Yeah.
With many conservative communities.
The thing is that we can't do anything about those demographics either.
No.
A 16% demographic of racists is going to remain 16%. It's not going to change. The portion of the electorate that we could have changed their minds are the ones that we forgot about, that Hillary Clinton forgot about. We're talking about the Rust Belt. We're talking about the blue-collar worker that does not see any silver lining in the status quo.
Right.
Again, I keep on coming back to the status quo, but this is what they railed against. They could have been approached,
mm-hmm.
and we did not. We failed to approach.
And that's my argument. So let's say 16% of the population are exactly...
Hardcore racist.
Are the hardcore people who really kind of need to be shamed in
some
ways.
And I made that up, so I don't
okay.
know what
All right,
that
let's just some number N.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go with that. Does that mean that everybody who stayed home and everybody who voted for Trump is in that N? Or is it a much wider group of people who voted for Trump in spite of his sexism, in spite of his racism, in spite of his demagoguery, for other reasons which we didn't consider?
Go
ahead.
My coworker and his wife, which I would consider, I never met his wife, but my coworker I would consider pretty liberal. But he called his vote for Trump brave. He actually saw it as an act of bravery for him and his wife to vote for Trump,
mm-hmm.
because the rhetoric has been just how bad Trump is. So we lost that demographic.
What was his expected outcome from a Trump victory? Did he say?
No, he just saw it as a brave vote. Just literally sees it as giving a finger to the system.
Well, that's the outcome then.
This is the throwing the Legos
up
in the air.
This is throwing the Legos in the air.
Like you just don't care.
Which is a much... which you kind of...
Sorry.
No.
It had been way more than 8 minutes.
No. That's good.
We needed the
thing. That's good. Is voting, is throwing the Legos in the air in this way, is this a much longer term thought than we think? It's like, it's not this guy that's going to fix it. I've heard a lot of Trump supporters say that. I don't really like this guy that much. I don't think he's going to do much. It's what happens afterwards that I'm more concerned with.
I mean, you could frame that as like, oh, it's a call to action to the Republican Party to actually put up a real damn nominee.
Right.
Right. It's like, don't bring us movement conservatives who don't have a policy portfolio, because the next guy who doesn't have a policy portfolio is going to waste
unlikely.
8 years of our lives.
That seems
right.
unlikely.
Yeah, that seems pretty unlikely to me, too.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like it's a call to action to the Democratic Party
mm-hmm.
by Republicans.
Right.
It's just like, please give us somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Give us somebody we can vote for on both sides, right? The Republicans, and for the Republicans, I think the Republicans want somebody who actually has a policy portfolio and some skill set. And for Democrats, they're like, at least find somebody who doesn't have such a familiar name to us and who we're not so damn used to and invested in setting on fire that we haven't literally built like a multi-billion dollar enterprise on it.
Right.
I see that. It's just, I don't understand how that thought process can persist in a person's head as long as it would have to in order to turn into an action to vote and not at some point or another get popped.
But my ultimate point here is that me, you, Josh, everybody I know on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
we're trying to get into the heads of people who voted for Trump who are not horrible human beings, because there's clearly a large population of them, and we don't have answers. That's on us. If we do not have adequate intel, how the hell do you think we're going to win this war?
That's fair.
Straight up.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of fear in me. Like I said, I fear for marriage equality. I fear for Roe v. Wade. I fear for, and we haven't said anything about this, boy, did the transgender community just get the rug pulled out from under them.
Right.
Because you just had Obama saying, you know, hey, use the bathroom you're supposed to use.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have President Trump. What the There's a lot of fear there right now. There absolutely should be a lot of fear right now. That's scary.
Right.
But we don't just stop. Some people are going to leave. Great. Okay. But I'm staying.
Mm-hmm.
And I want this to work better. And Josh came here with notes. You came in the room and you said, I want to keep this positive. Sorry.
I kind of felt at that, too. I think we all have. It's really hard to stay positive.
It is incredibly difficult.
But we got a job to do, and if we can't stay positive, we need to at least stay project focused. We need to stay in line to get things done. And you came here with notes. You're ready to talk about this. So I want to hear.
So what's your answer to Jed Bartlett's consistent question? What's next?
Right. What is next?
So what's next?
See, that's the problem, though. I mean, we're focused on ending the game. We thought that by having Hillary Clinton, which we believed to be a sure thing, that would allow us to at least end the game for the next 4 years.
Right.
We're not focusing on the short game. We're not focusing on the real long games. The problem is that we gave up almost all of the governorship. I mean, I wouldn't say all, but a majority of governorship is now Republican, which is a big deal.
The House is Republican, the Senate is Republican, the White House is Republican. Yeah,
and a majority of states have Republican governors. A majority of states have Republican state houses.
Yeah,
that's a big deal.
That
did not change, by the way.
Right,
that's not an advent of 2016 where suddenly we need to deal with a huge number of states that have Republican governorships.
So basically, everybody that's focusing on 2020 right now has the wrong focus. We should be looking at every election process from here on out. We should not be focusing only on presidential, because that's the only time that liberals ever turn out. And that bit us in the ass in 2000, and that bit us in the ass this year.
Yeah.
Pardon my French.
I mean, we've got, I've sworn a couple times already. we've got, there's an election in 2017. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the 2018 midterm, which could be more important than the 2020 presidential election. And liberals, as a group, tend to not think in terms of midterm elections.
Silver lining, though?
Yeah.
Usually the midterm elections turn against the incumbent president.
Right.
So silver lining, but don't count on that. Get out there and work
Did that happen in I actually literally don't remember. How did 2002 go?
2002 went weird because 2002 was also a war year.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Was the run up to the war.
Right. 2006 went in our favor. We took the Senate and
right.
the House.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. your favor. still only one socialist, sorry. Yeah, okay, that's it. I am a socialist. I don't think I've ever actually just said it that
plainly
on the air. Yeah, mm-hmm. I am a socialist.
I would consider myself like socialist light. I still like capitalism, but I think a lot of social ideas need to be implemented. Right now, I mean, people go bankrupt. The number one reason to go bankrupt is our health care.
Right.
And
yeah, I consider myself something of an evidence-based socialism, but that's a conversation. Evidence-based socialist, but that's a conversation for another day. Like, I'm not really a big believer of the revolution. I'm not a big dialectic kind of guy, even though I can talk like
right.
that, if you like.
I think that's the only reason why I actually find your socialism acceptable. no, because the revolution thing is always hysterical. Like, whenever I'm listening, like the Bernie Bro the Bernie Bro phenomenon
right.
of talking about the revolution,
mm-hmm.
I'm like. You lose a revolution. You like, you know, the colored belt wearing, tight pants wearing, complaining about how you want to listen to everything on vinyl. You lose the revolution.
So you don't like White Stripes fans, is what
you're saying. essentially.
Okay. Yeah, we got to pay attention to the 2010 election. We got to pay attention to
2010 kind of is a little in our hindsight.
Yeah.
No. But you're talking about, we need to pay attention. Yeah. So you're saying the 2006.
2006
is the model.
2006 is our model.
Right.
But I think we need to learn from the 2010 election as
gotcha.
Well.
Yes.
Because the 2010 election was the coming of the Tea Party.
Right.
And I think there needs to be a serious sea change on the left side of the political spectrum in the United States. And I think it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point, the Democratic Party has manifestly lost. They ain't got nothing. They're kind of permanently the minority party right now. And if we had anything even approaching a parliamentary system. And there needs to be a change. I mean, Bernie Sanders and company is already job-handed on that. They're already floating some guy for running for the Democratic National Committee.
You talk about Elias.
Oh, Keith Ellison.
Keith Ellison.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's going to be awesome. He's Muslim.
Really?
Yeah. That's going to be amazing.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keith Ellison is Muslim.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Just take it from there. And where would you have people go?
Again, focusing on your community, focus on the ground game.
Yeah.
Stop focusing on the big show, because that's where we lost at. We focused all our efforts on the big show, lost it, and so we lost any chance to actually take back the House or Senate. House was never up for grabs. It was that was a pipe dream.
No, yeah, that was never in
the
play.
The Senate could have been ours.
Yeah. Now, there are some good sides there. I mean, we got Tammy Duckworth in Illinois,
absolutely,
who's amazing.
A veteran.
Veteran, yeah. I mean, John McCain won, but only just, versus Ann Kirkpatrick, which was a race I followed very closely. Joe Arpaio lost.
Yeah, but
finally.
Sorry, continue. We'll talk a little bit about what we think Donald Trump is going to do at some point.
Yeah.
Because we don't know anything about that. I can see him nominating Joe Arpaio to the Supreme Court.
I don't know that Joe Arpaio is staying out of jail at this point.
Well, now that he's not in office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He is not well liked. Right. I would get calls from Maricopa County sheriffs saying, "Are you voting against Arpaio?" Yeah. All right. Catch you later.
Right.
Yeah, that happened. I lived in his town.
Right.
Anything else? Anything else we should be talking about that we're not?
Well, we got to actually be the party of reality. We have to avoid conspiracy theories. We have to keep everything real. Even Trump is not going to be the complete arsonist that people believe he is. There are going to be the things that we could probably influence him on.
Right.
And we must focus on those. We must not completely alienate ourselves out of that system. But we need to not fall for the rhetoric that the right falls for when they're on defense.
So there's
on the offense.
There's a metaphoric challenge, I think, that there's this metaphor that we talk about having about being practical and being pragmatic and knowing and nominating people for office, whether it be the president or down ticket races or off season or midterm races, people who know how to play the game. I think that metaphor, we run into problems with that metaphor. So I want to break it apart. I think there's two different games we should be talking about. One of them is people who have a policy portfolio, a set of ideas, and an understanding of how that process actually works and know how to get things done in Washington or in their state or in their governor's mansion. Mm-hmm. In that specific context, we need people who know how to play the game.
Sure.
In another context, we need people who hate the game and want to end it. And that is creating a government that is strongly rooted in social justice, creating a policy portfolio that is about expanding the definition of American to a wider range of people who live in this country and who have citizenship in this country. I think in that realm, we need people who absolutely hate the game.
Right.
But when we use this metaphor of people who know how to play the game, that immediately triggers people's anti-status quo feelings and rule set. And they're like, well, people who know how to play the game are the reason why we got here in the first place. And they start talking about the banks. And they start talking about people who are in bed with Wall Street. And they start talking about people whose experience now plays against them.
Right.
I think that is, when I think about what we need to do in the midterms, when I think about what we need to do, like, even in 2017, that's what we need to focus on at the state level, at the local level, at the city level, the county level. That's what we need to focus on. We need to focus on those two distinctions. People who are competent and capable in the administrative roles and have strong burnished credentials in social justice.
Well, when I say people who know how to play the game, I mean, in order to change the game, one needs to know what rules they're changing. You can't just take a fire axe to it.
Mm-hmm.
People die.
Right.
Easy. I think we need to be a little bit more inclusive. I think you're right in saying we need to be a little bit more inclusive of people who know how to play the game to include people who know what the game is and want to change.
Right.
That's, as far as I'm concerned, that's a part of knowing how to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we had this election cycle.
Right.
I mean, we could have, but we didn't.
Right, no, and so the elephant in the room is Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
I'm literally making the argument for Bernie Sanders.
Okay.
But I'm not making the argument for Bernie Sanders in 2020. I'm saying there's a gajillion Bernie Sanderses running at the local level.
I don't even think...
And we need to find them all. And they all need to be the face of the... They need to be the face of the Democratic Party so that in 2020, it's a no-brainer to either nominate Bernie Sanders or a Bernie Sanders-type figure.
Yeah.
Who has that peculiar set of characteristics as their on their resume of being competent and experienced in government and being rooted in social justice and in expanding the American... expanding the American experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think those two things are hard to find.
And this is my socialism coming out to the fore, is that when we talk social justice, I think we even need to become a little bit more inclusive there and have a better, maybe not call it class, but have a larger discussion about the nature of class in the United States. We need a social justice movement that's concerned with raising the floor.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that's something that I don't think the community that I choose to speak to and represent here on the show has done a very good job of, is that our social justice focus, which is something that I want. I'm not saying I'm against it. Holy cats, no.
Right.
Like I said, if you don't believe that now, tune me out.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to be more concerned with class. I think we need to be more concerned with wealth disparity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we made a better case for that, a lot of these people who stayed home and a lot of these people who voted for Trump might not have voted the way they did. And this is what I mean, but I think it's time to sit down and break bread with some racists. Figure out what the f*** is going on in their head.
And that's kind of why I was talking about the idea of not othering them.
Yeah.
The joking version of that, like, so that not othering racists is the sort of social criticism way of articulating that.
Yeah.
The non-social criticism, like the sort of sarcastic way of articulating that, is we need to learn to be more open to the needs and the desires of racist Americans.
Yeah.
And when I say racist Americans, I literally am putting a hyphen in there. Racist Americans, misogynist Americans, homophobic Americans, like we need to make sure that we have a space, and we need to give them a seat at the table.
And a tactical model.
Right.
That would be nice.
I'm sorry. I'm going to push back on this.
Go for it.
I don't understand. I mean, so you really want to actually... I mean, I understand, like, not discounting them completely, but are we talking, like, just, like, borderline? Or are we talking about all of them? Are we talking about people
we're slightly facetious.
We're f***ing around a
little bit. Yeah, we're f***ing around.
Scaring me there. I'm like, what?
My point is there's a population of people who... are racist Americans. There's a population of people, those people, misogynist Americans.
Right. Yeah.
They are there. They had a big part to play.
Right.
In this election cycle.
But there's a larger...
Why did the existence of these people not put the fear into the people who voted for Trump? How did these groups of people not put the fear in the people who decided to stay home because the system is rigged? I don't think we as a community who are social justice focused, I don't think we as a community who want equality full stop, who want the kind of country that our founding documents suggested we wanted, even though they didn't, because that's why we have the Electoral College. The sort of democracy, the sort of republic where human rights are universal full stop. That's what we need. We don't really have a model of what those other people think. We don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's another piece of this. So you were mentioning kind of this, there's people who are racist and there are people who are people who are genuinely racist, like they identify racism. When you ask them, what are you? They're like, I'm a racist. Nobody actually does that. But there are people who will hint at racism, but they won't come out about it. And then there's people who are genuinely, they're out about their racism.
Right.
We literally are going to have to get used to using this terminology. But they're out about their racism. They're not in the racist closet.
But does everybody who voted for Trump and everybody stay home, do you think they all have Stormfront accounts?
No. There's a bunch of people who are okay with racism if it gets them where they need to be.
Right.
Like people who don't their Uber driver, even though their Uber driver is racist and is listening to the wrong radio station. They're like, well, he literally gets me where I need to be. I don't need to give him bad stars because being an Uber driver isn't about politics. It's about driving a car.
Right.
And I think that's that mindset what we saw in Trump voters was a combination of out and out racists, like the Klan endorsed my guy,
right?
Like that kind of thing, right? So like the David Duke Republican, and the sort of racist adjacent, the racist tolerant. And the racist tolerant is actually probably a huge swath of Americans.
It absolutely is.
Those are the people I think we need to reach out to.
Yeah.
Those are the people we need to say, I get where you're coming from, that racism isn't a deal breaker for you. I need you to understand that it is a deal breaker for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I need you to understand that that disagreement, that it's not a deal breaker for you and it's a deal breaker for me, that should not be the reason we stop talking to each other.
And I think that I think we should even go a little bit further and take the conversation as, I don't convert people to atheism. I don't evangelize about atheism.
Right.
We'll talk about atheism.
What is that even? Is it called nihilangelism?
I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. I talk about why atheists should have a place at the table, mm-hmm. to religious people. Why you should work with us. Why you should consider us human beings. I don't say you should be an atheist. I will say I think atheism is the superior position. Because I do. Because mm-hmm. it's mine.
Right.
But I think we do need to evangelize a little bit to a lot of these racist tolerant people. I think we need to come in and say, like, no, look, racism has effects that you're not going to like, that you are not going to like already. I don't need to convince you to not like these things. There are things I know you don't like that are going to happen if you continue to be tolerant to this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the kind of conversation we need to have. And you don't get that by othering these people and say, if you live with racists, if you work with racists, if you don't care about racism, you yourself are a racist and I'll never speak to you again.
Right. Then you close them off and
yeah.
you have forever lost somebody that could be an ally.
Because you're making the barrier between those two positions so stark that that crossing over it is a political act.
And I know for a significant population of the racist tolerant Americans that we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
the fact that they have been ostracized from people who are not racist tolerant did influence their decisions mm-hmm. in this election cycle. That's becoming clear.
Well, and they were also, and you started this out talking about how we've been shame casting.
Right.
And I think that's another part of it as well, is that there was no sort of counter argument to the shame casting that people were doing about the racist tolerant
mm-hmm.
voting for Trump.
Right.
That it was like, well, you should be ashamed of your choice. It's like, well, I'm not ashamed of my choice because my choice isn't racism. My choice is not Hillary Clinton. And my choice not being Hillary Clinton isn't a shameful thing.
No,
it's a thing you disagree with.
Okay, no, like,
let me rephrase. I personally think it is, but the reason I think it is because I value competence in my elected officials, and that competence factor for president of the United States, the president of the United States being an administrator, the president of the United States being head of the executive branch,
right,
the head of the largest organization in the United States. And the largest employer in the United States requires an extraordinary amount of executive and administrative competence. And that competence is a deal breaker. Not having that competence is a deal breaker for me.
Well, this takes.
Not only do I consider Trump to be a misogynist and a racist and a homophobe, nonsense human being, I also consider him to be an incompetent administrator of large organizations.
Well, fortunately, his incompetence may save us.
It may, but the thing is, he could surround himself with really capable,
which he's
evil
already
people.
Doing. He's already packing,
and he is surrounding himself with really competent evil people.
He's packing. He's packing it with insiders. But
right.
I didn't support Hillary Clinton. I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I did a write-in candidate. And does that mean I was throwing my vote away? Yes. I am willing to say that, I think I've said it before on this episode already, Hillary Clinton might be the most competent politician we have today. I have a lot of reasons to not support Hillary Clinton that had nothing to do with duplicitousness or falsity or conspiracy theories. I need a little bit more than competence. I don't want a more subtle Henry Kissinger, and that's what I felt like I was getting with Hillary Clinton.
Right, and we were all Bernie Sanders supporters.
Right. Well, no, we were. I don't know if he was.
No, I wasn't.
You were not?
Hello, okay. Secretary of State. Do you want to? Shall we look at the record as Secretary of State? I mean, there's a there.
It's okay. All right. Okay.
And that was a big conversation with me. It's like, and I was safe. I felt okay voting for a different choice here in Washington State. Because even if the polling was off by like an order of magnitude, Hillary Clinton was still going to carry Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
In Arizona, I was saying, vote for Hillary Clinton. If I lived in Arizona, I would have voted for Hillary Clinton, because that would have been electoral votes right out of the GOP's hide. It would have been right out of, well, Donald, the GOP, whatever, Donald Trump's hide. That would have been a big win for Hillary. And so I was like, and for,
but Washington State wasn't on the fence.
Washington State was never on the fence, even with the crap polling we got. The polling just got this whole thing wrong.
Yes.
And that was, like, I was telling people not to worry about it. Look at the polling. Polling has never been this incorrect in my lifetime.
Yeah, everybody wants to put Nate Silver's head on a pike at this point.
Well, that's what happens when Cassandra complex. I mean, that's exactly,
right. When you decide to build an entire brand around your ability to prognosticate, then when you fail to prognosticate, people are going to get pissed. I get that. There's probably a really good, I mean, there's maybe a follow-up conversation that we could have around, what it means for the polling to be as bad as it was. I think part of it, we've touched on some of it around social media and around the creation of, there's a word for this. There's a word for this thing, this sort of social insulation that comes from the sort of automated algorithmic curation of our world. Epistemic closure. Da-da-da!
Yeah.
I remembered it. Yeah, so epistemic closure. I think epistemic closure probably plays a part in that, and we've always considered that to be something that the liberal community or the progressive community probably wouldn't be susceptible to because they didn't all watch Fox News.
Right.
So Fox News was like the sort of poster child example of epistemic closure, but we now know that that's no longer a phenomena that's limited to Republicans or to conservatives.
Right.
So I think that for me is the big takeaway of the polling.
Yeah. I mean, I want to wrap this up because this is now the longest segment Ask an Atheist has ever done. But the fact of the matter is, this is worth talking about in the context of an atheist show, even though we're not talking about atheism at all, because literally every person I know who's an atheist is scared right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It needs to be talked about. And I'm going to quote Babylon 5, and I said, I now have an opportunity to become something better, stronger, more difficult than I've ever been before.
Mm-hmm.
And I've decided to take that path, and it's going to lose me some friends, because a lot of people are going to hear me saying things like, I think we're going to need to break bread with racists to figure out what the hell is going on. And they're going to see that as advocating bigotry. Mm-hmm. And that's not advocating bigotry. This is all in the service of ending bigotry. You need to get inside people's brains to figure out what's going on.
This is why I keep saying we need to recognize that they have an American experience. We need to also make a distinction between the racist adjacent, the racist tolerant, if you will, the phrase I was using earlier, and the genuine racist.
Yeah. And because I'm saying stuff like that, there's a lot of people in the atheism community who I love to death, who I think I'm going to lose on this episode. But I want this to end. I don't want to see this again in my lifetime. And I'm going to do what I think it takes to make that not happen.
And to that group of people, I would actually like to say, don't make the mistake we made. Don't make the decision that you're not going to continue to listen to someone because they have said a thing that you don't agree with. Ask why and continue the conversation.
I'm not going to force them. If you don't want the kind of person I am around you, okay. I'm okay with that. But just realize that I'm making the decisions that I'm making because I think we're both trying to work for the same kind of world.
Right.
I think we have the same goal in mind. I think we're just taking different paths. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about something else, anything else, literally. Talk about popcorn, anything.
And I'm Casey Dorn, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVsTheMartians.com.
I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it will explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
Has Ngatwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster Ngatwe Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an Ngatwe Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at Original Motto. .us.
The Humanists of Washington is the oldest humanist organization in the state and offers a community of free thinkers who educate the public and celebrate life. Come celebrate life with us. Humanists support intellectual freedom and critical thinking and hold that human beings are autonomous centers of moral development. You can become a member of the Humanists of Washington at humanistsofwashington.org. You'll get our quarterly publication, The Secular Humanist Press. Check out meetup.com where you can be part of our monthly Seattle dinner and our Heathens Do It Better breakfast. Humanists of Washington.
You still here? Great. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. Now we'll talk about a thing. An upcoming BBC 4 documentary called The Undiscovered Peter Cook will feature an unaired radio comedy from 1964 that was discarded out of fear that it might break British and American anti-blasphemy laws of the time. The so-called Dead Sea Tapes include comedic alternative would-be gospels that were not included in the biblical canon. I don't really have much to say about this, otherwise I really want to hear this. I'm really looking forward to it.
It's Peter Cook.
Yeah,
he's a genius, or he was a genius. He can, if there was a heaven, he continues to be a genius.
His work is his work is genius. Let's put it that way. Let's get Talmudic on it. His work is great, and I like. And Dudley Moore is also a great communicant person.
I'm super excited about this.
Yeah, me too.
I remember I remember the first time I discovered Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and it was watching the original Bedazzled.
Mm.
Their style of humor is irreverent, but deeply educated.
Yeah,
like they do the reading. I mean, it was before Dogma. It was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Yeah,
like even more so than the Monty Python crowd, perhaps even more so than Stephen Fry. And Hugh Laurie.
Yeah, I mean, modern times you got Stephen Fry, Hugh mm-hmm. Laurie, David Mitchell mm-hmm. Is a good example of that. But David Mitchell, I kind of sometimes, as much as I love him, seems to rub the reading in your face a little bit, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, but that's part of his, I think part of David Mitchell's shtick is being posh.
Yeah.
Right? So he's like, he's that guy from Eton that you actually agree with. Which means
as much as I might not want to.
Right.
Fair. My brain's fried, man. After that slog. All right, so let's do some emails. And I think I'm going to do some sort of bright emails here that make me happy. The first one comes from Philip from Seattle, who says, "My friend and I came to the after party last Sunday. My friend has been excited to meet you all since he moved to Seattle a few months ago, but I must confess I had never listened to Ask an Atheist. I have been binge listening since Monday, and I really love your content. Keep up the good work. My best, Philip." binge listening. Wow, I don't know that I could stand that much of my own voice. And I love talking.
You do realize this means that Philip may not know whether or not there's been two people, there's been three people on this show or two people on this
show. Oh, and they might have heard that now, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He may get this. So, like, this may be the first time that he actually gets... We have a control group now.
Yeah, we do.
Philip, thank you for joining. Thank you for listening.
Okay. We have some good answers. This is Joel from Facebook, who writes, on some recent episodes, we've pondered about devout Muslims who generally pray facing Mecca and how they might pray if they were on Mars. Joel from Facebook writes, a Muslim on Mars may have fewer problems than a Muslim in orbit around Earth, given the speed of the ISS. But that has already been addressed. Joel linked to an article describing a fatwa that was issued in 2007 after 150 Muslim scientists and scholars were called upon by the Malaysian Space Agency to interpret Muslim practice given weightlessness, orbital speed, washing protocol, and other complexities of being on the ISS. The result is that Muslim astronauts on the ISS don't have to wash their face and hands with water and may prostrate themselves to the extent allowable by a spacesuit or gravity conditions. Regarding where to face, they have four options. Face the Kaaba on the land, which will move relative to the ISS, face the projection of the Kaaba in the sky, face the Earth, or face anywhere. Fasting is done according to the timing of the place of launch. This all came to the fore in advance of Malaysian astronaut Sheikh Muzaffar Shukor's service on the ISS in 2007. He was reportedly the ninth Muslim in outer space. I'm not making fun of nobody here. This is the kind of stuff I wonder at stuff like this, because I think, we're going to go into space as humans.
Right.
I have that optimism.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're going to get rid of religion anytime soon. And
right.
So
we're going to have to figure out how to do those two things at the same time. We're going to have to figure out how to believe in fantastical things and believe in fantastical things.
Right.
Like space travel at the consumer level in our lifetime.
Right.
I especially love the catch-all that part four includes, is face anywhere.
Yeah.
Just don't even worry this about seems, it at this point.
Yeah, this seems like the fatwa implementation of I don't know.
Right. We'll figure it out.
And then, in the pre-show round, we were wondering at the physical properties of this. Does prayer propagate at the speed of light? Is an instantaneous thing? Is prayer affected by gravity? Like, what if you're on Jalice B or something like
that? Is faith a particle or a wave?
Well, yes, likely. I mean, yeah, because that's what everything is now, isn't it?
Right.
And it's like...
Heisenberg may have prayed here.
Yeah. It's like, if there's a black hole between you and Earth, what do you do? Does the prayer get stuck
in a gravity well?
No, I'm being fun here, but I wonder at stuff like that.
But somebody has to think about that. I mean, and 150, apparently 150 Muslims,
yeah,
of fairly well-educated Muslims being fairly educated Muslims, as well as fairly well-educated about physics, about science, about astral navigation, actually had to figure this out.
Right.
Because the Malaysian government, being a state that espouses Islam,
yeah,
as their state faith, actually had to make this decision. And I kind of like the idea of applying the rule set and interpreting it in modern context for modern problems.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that finds the interpretation of the Talmud by rabbinical scholars is watching football on the Sabbath work?
Right.
Well, it is, but it isn't. So you've got to figure out how to get your television to turn itself on so you're not pressing a button and connecting the thing to another thing in order to complete a circuit, because that's work.
Right.
Or can I use an elevator on the Sabbath? I mean, those kinds of things.
Yeah. And, we've talked about that on the show before, and I'm not a big fan of religion, but I do... Every atheist I think I've ever talked to finds some aspect of religion fascinating.
Well, it's a rule
sometimes,
set.
Sometimes like a car crash, but sometimes, yeah, because it's a rule set and because people have to live with these things. And it's interesting to see implementations of it. And, Yumi and Becky have talked about this
right
till several cows came inside the wire border of our neighborhood.
Right. And then we argued about whether they were the right cows.
Right. Yeah, we did. And this is just an outreach of that. But I was always afraid to ask for details on it because it seemed like hitting the Pascal's wager button. It's like this is probably a question they get all the time, and it may be a vaguely insulting question. I don't really want to insult people unless I mean to insult people.
Right. But you're not going to accidentally do it. I'm not going to casually kind of sidle into an insult.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it facing you. I'm going to square up and we're going to get this done.
Right. Yeah. Man, my brain is starting to fade pretty bad, isn't it? So any closing words, Josh?
All is not lost.
All is not lost. And I'd give you closing thoughts, but I think you've had seven now.
The only thing I was going to do is the thing I thought about opening with, which was we should all be proud of our first atheist president.
An autotheist is not the same thing as an atheist, Ron John. We've had this discussion. Why can't be a Mason? I got to close on an email.
Okay.
I'm going to close on an email. This is Pat from Ottawa, Canada, and this is the reason why I did this episode the way I did it. And he writes, "Good morning, Sam and the crew. Voices like yours have suddenly become far more important both in the U.S. and in the rest of the world. Hang in there, keep doing what you do, and if the atheist can ever receive a calling from a higher power, this is it. Good luck, friends." Like I said, it's going to be a little bit more difficult, but I do think my job just became a little bit more important.
The call to action is clear. I think that's the takeaway.
Yeah.
We
were too complacent. We have to... The game never ends.
I hate to admit it, but I think I may have been too complacent. I think you're right. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. If you're listening to... If you're this far in, congratulations. We made it through. Thank you, Ron John.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv. Give us a voicemail at 844-753-7842. You can see us on Facebook. You can go to our Twitter, which is AskAnAtheistWA. We will see you next week. Well, at least you will hear us next week. See you then.